Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Preserving Hope by Alex Albrink. Narrated by Todd McLaren. Prologue. Will Stark watched the villagers seal the lid of Elizabeth Lowell's coffin. She had been the daughter of Genevieve and Arthur Lowell. Genevieve wasn't here to watch as the simple pine box holding her only child was lowered into the grave. Genevieve wasn't able to cry until there were no more tears to cry. Nor was she able to curse her every breath as one stolen from the young woman buried that day. Genevieve had found her eternal rest 3 years earlier, and now she waited in silence as Elizabeth became her eternal companion. Arthur, though, had to live through the event, not shielded from every parent's worst nightmare, the nightmare of burying your own child. For Arthur, the experience was far more profound, for deep down he knew that his only child was dead before her 20th birthday, because of his own greed and selfishness. At least, he should have known that. Arthur had been part of a group of slaves who had escaped into the wilds of medieval northern England, revolting against returning to a life of servitude. The group had been forced to serve as human test subjects for a baron desirous of getting his slaves to live longer and work harder by freeing them of the diseases and ill health that lessened his return on his investment in human capital. If the experiments worked, they'd be healthy. If the experiments failed, as they had with earlier groups, then the slaves would die. The experiments with Arthur's group had succeeded, but had the curious side effect of giving that group of slaves a thirst for freedom that could not be quenched. Arthur and the others had escaped, built up modest wealth, and had constructed a thriving village. There, they'd conducted experiments of their own choosing, seeking a far greater payoff than mere good health. The experiments were all conducted by a single volunteer, a young girl hired each day to test out every possible magical substance reputed to provide a payoff of mythical proportions. Though she worked against her will and received none of the money paid for her services, the young girl, Elizabeth, was expected to freely share any breakthroughs with those who enslaved her. In the end, though, the experiments had led only to the early and violent death of that girl. Two women had protested her treatment, Genevieve and the young woman who had come to be a second mother to Elizabeth, and those protests had led to those women preceding Elizabeth in death. For Arthur, these three deaths were a small price to pay to gain the knowledge and power he sought above all else. Several of the men of the village pounded nails into the wood, sealing the box for eternity, just after Will caught a final glimpse of Elizabeth. Her hair was a flaming red color, like that of Will's daughter, Angel, but in death it lacked the same vibrancy. Elizabeth's hair now looked like the dying embers remaining from a once great fire, the dirty hair matted against her head with blood and sweat. The bruises still marred her face, never having had the chance to heal before her body functions ceased. Her blue eyes, a window into the sadness of her life, were hidden behind eyelids sealed shut from the beating she'd endured. Her neighbors, roused to a fearful passion, aided by Elizabeth's own father, had exacted their final toll. After a decade of physical trauma and emotional neglect, Arthur had disowned his own daughter in her time of greatest need and peril, delivering Elizabeth to her early grave rather than standing up for the daughter he'd long ceased to show any fondness. Instead, the former slave had discarded his own child when she no longer served him any purpose. Will bent to the ground and grasped one of the three long wooden poles used to lift and carry the coffin. At a count of three, he joined the two women and three men in standing up and lifting the pine box off the ground for transport to the gravesite. They walked in silence, pausing as Will momentarily lost his balance. There were no tears shed during this solemn time, for outside of one of the men carrying the coffin, they all bore a share of the guilt for the young woman's demise, a fatality that seemed predestined. No priest presided over the ceremony, for none of them wanted to be reminded of the terrible guilt they all shared. The earth had already been removed from Elizabeth's final resting place. The dirt sat in a large pile atop Genevieve's grave, preventing anyone from stepping there. The pallbearers placed the pine box atop the open grave, where the wooden poles allowed the coffin to remain above ground. Will and two other men unrolled three coils of sturdy rope, which were fed under the coffin. The pallbearers lifted the box a few inches off the ground using the ropes, and one of the villagers removed the three poles from beneath the coffin. Inch by inch, the six lowered the box down into the grave until it reached the bottom with finality, a fitting end to a young life. They dropped the lengths of rope into the hole and stepped back. Arthur Lowell stepped forward. As the father of the deceased, it was his duty to speak.
"We have suffered a great loss. Elizabeth was a young woman of beauty, possessing a generosity of spirit rare among any I've ever met. She has uniquely contributed to the success of this community, and we mourn that she will be unable to continue to share in that success. In her memory, we must continue to move forward along the path she cleared, to see the sights she made available for all of us. In many ways, she epitomizes what we are striving to be, ever seeking to push the boundaries of human development. We will not let her death be in vain."
There were murmurs of agreement and appreciation of his words. Will looked around at the small assembly, incredulous. "That was a beautiful speech, Arthur. Why, if I didn't know any better, I'd think her death was of her own choosing. Let me offer my eulogy. Today, this young woman is laid to rest as a human sacrifice on the altar of greed, laziness, and cowardice. She is mourned by those gathered here, not because they truly sorrow at her loss, but because they do not know where the next sacrificial victim will be found. They cry not because she is gone, but because they fear they'll be the next chosen to join her, the next innocent bludgeoned to death by so-called neighbors. None of you have any right to be standing on this ground. You all bear the guilt of her demise, regardless of the number of blows you delivered." Most of the eyes in the gathering fell to the ground, their silence speaking volumes to the guilt they bore and the truth of his words. Arthur's eyes blazed in anger.
"How dare you?" he hissed. "How dare you belittle her in such a fashion? My daughter worked harder than anyone here to unlock the secrets we know wait just beyond our grasp, teasing us with their potential. And you tarnish her memory before the dirt is in her grave?"
Will marched straight to Arthur, until he could lean down and stare directly into the shorter man's terrified eyes. "Get out of here, now, Arthur." Will turned around, his gaze taking in all those assembled. "All of you, leave this place. You gave this woman no peace during her life. You failed to give her a childhood full of fun and play and laughter. You never gave her the love all children so desperately need. You feign interest in her now, as if you expect that to atone for the crimes you've committed against her. Her life is over. It's too late to seek forgiveness now. Leave, so that her final burial is performed by hands that didn't drive her into that grave." Will turned back to Arthur and again stared down the shorter man, who finally withered under his gaze. Arthur turned and left the clearing, followed by the rest of the villagers, leaving Will alone with the coffin and the empty grave. Silence followed their departure, suggesting that he was alone. But Will knew that Arthur had not gone all the way back to the village with the others. After a few moments of quiet contemplation kneeling by the coffin, Will stood and seized a shovel. He began pushing the dirt back into the open grave, covering the coffin and filling the hole. He worked without stopping, ignoring the sweat beating on his forehead and dampening his clothes. Once the grave was filled with dirt, Will located a small piece of rope on the ground nearby and used it to fashion a small cross from two tree branches. He pushed the marker into the ground and knelt down. He allowed the tears to flow, weeping over the torturous life the young woman had lived. He wept at the love she'd so desperately sought from her father, love that the man had never reciprocated. He wept at the horror at the realization that the same man had permitted and encouraged her final end. Will rose to his feet and marched into the trees where Arthur stood watching the entire scene. "You loved her, didn't you?" It wasn't a question that Arthur directed at Will. It was an accusation, one designed to twist the emotional knife just a bit deeper and perhaps locate a weak point for future exploitation. Will fixed Arthur with a steady gaze, his eyes bright with malice toward the shorter man. "I will love her until the end of my days." And then he punched Arthur squarely in the face, turned, and headed away from the village, ignoring Arthur's cries of pain. He needed to get as far from this spot as possible. Only then could he determine if the woman lying in the box was still alive, or if he'd accidentally killed his future wife. 1. Village. The morning sun rested low in the sky, casting its early summer rays over an empty field in the wilds of northern England. In the distance, off to the west and north, loomed a large forest boasting magnificent old trees that had survived for centuries. Two rivers merged into one north of the main body of the forest, the smaller branches of water surrounding the ancient trees in a loving embrace. There was only a single human in sight, a tall man with jet-black hair carrying nothing but the bag of coins in his pocket. He walked awkwardly, his feet protesting the unusual shoes he was forced to wear as he made his way through the fields between the two rivers and toward the forest. 2 months earlier, as he'd lived those months, he'd experienced a similar issue with footwear. He tried to sprint the length of a long, winding driveway toward his home in business shoes not designed for such use. Those torturous footsteps marked the beginning of a dramatic transformation in his life, a transformation that now saw him walking in an open field thousands of miles from the land he called home, 1,000 years before he'd even been born. Though he knew what he was supposed to do in these strange lands and stranger times, he had little idea of how it would be accomplished. 2 months earlier, Will Stark had been an incredibly successful businessman and philanthropist, living his dream life with the woman he loved and their young son. He'd arrived at the entry to their gated community, a community built to provide them security against those who meant them harm, to find the guards slaughtered and a killer on the loose inside the fortress-like walls. He'd run to try to save his family, for his car was blocked from entry by the very security he'd designed. He'd been too late. His house had exploded into a massive fireball, ending the lives of his wife and son who were still inside. Will had been attacked and beaten as he tried to get inside the house in a futile effort to save them. Two men and a woman had rescued him and healed him, using incredibly advanced medical devices based on nanotechnology. Will was introduced to the Alliamenti, a group which had mastered the development and use of energy, an inner force capable of incredible actions like telepathy, empathy, telekinesis, clairvoyance, and, for the most advanced practitioners, teleportation. The Alliamenti prescribed harsh penalties for sharing the knowledge of developing this energy and associated abilities with the outside world, and a small faction had broken away in protest, choosing to pursue the goal of advancing all of humanity from the shadows, rather than suppressing them. The core Alliamenti leadership formed a trio of hunters who would track down deserters. An assassin would kill any humans suspected of having knowledge of the Alliamenti or their technological advancements. They believed Will the most prominent of the deserters, and the explosion, fire, and attack were triggered by the assassin and hunters for that reason. They'd realized Will wasn't who, or more accurately, what, they'd expected as they'd prepared to incarcerate him. Will had been rescued by members of the Breakaway faction, the Alliance, and they'd healed his wounds and taught him the secrets of energy. They'd also introduced their secret technology based on self-directed, problem-solving nanomachines that could collaborate in sufficient numbers to perform nearly any activity, all without detection by the hunters. Will, seeing in those skills and machines the chance to avenge his family, or, failing that, to prevent others from suffering the same fate, had progressed in rapid fashion until he'd drawn the attention of the hunters and assassin again. In the process of meeting the hunters and their leader, Will had learned he'd been living nearly 2 centuries into his future since the time of his rescue, among people who had learned to live, effectively, forever. Those who'd saved him admitted that he'd been brought forward to the future in a time machine. When the trio offered him the chance to use the time machine to go back and save his wife and son, Will had literally leaped at the chance. He'd been made aware of several challenges in such a trip, the most notable being the fact that nobody named Will Stark existed on the planet after the fire. He'd either succeeded or died trying. And in this case, dying might mean he'd had to end his own life to protect the integrity of history. Even then, he'd accepted his duty. As the time machine started its journey, he'd learned that one of the men helping him, and aggravating him, was his own grown son, Josh, and that the woman was the grown daughter he'd never known he'd had. Now, he found himself in the distant past, knowing only that a young hope was in some unspecified danger, and that Will, with his advanced energy skills and nanomachines, was to protect her. The letter he'd received indicated only that she was 16 years old. Will had also inferred, based upon his history lessons, that he was arriving at a time when the original Alliamenti hadn't yet figured out how to live forever or unleash their energy. His abilities and technology, therefore, would give him tremendous advantages. Yet, based on his beliefs and the promises he'd made to his own children, no matter the deception, he wouldn't use those advantages to impose his own will. That meant he'd rely on the skills he'd built in his business dealings to read the emotions and body language of others, rather than using empathy and telepathy to remove the risk of misreading. He'd use those advanced energy skills and the nanos for protecting himself and others he found in danger, especially Hope. But he'd not actively try to hurt or coerce others. He also decided not to arm himself with a sword or bow or whatever form of weapon was common in this era. He could protect himself from any foe or weapon, and suspected that choosing to be unarmed would make him seem a lesser threat. Then again, considering that he'd been thoroughly manipulated by his children into accepting this mission, he might not be much of a threat, regardless of the advantages he held. They'd maneuvered every concern he had back to saving Hope and Josh from a fire, or guilt over having failed to prevent their deaths, until he'd finally snapped. When they'd offer him the chance to save the two of them, his affirmative response was assured. They'd done their duty, and it allowed them to send Will back in time to the year 1018 A.D. Now, they expected him to do his duty and make sure that Elizabeth, her name in this era, survived. Right now, he hated his future self for his good fortune in meeting Hope, and he'd like the chance to ground his children and take away their allowances for lying to their father and not allowing him to make his own decision, fully informed, about his centuries-long journey. He vowed he'd never mislead others in the way he'd been misled. And though he'd been deceived as to the nature of his mission, the objective was one he'd attack with fervor. Hope, regardless of her age or name, was someone he'd always be willing to protect, regardless of the inconvenience or pain it might bring to him. His only guidance on this journey of 1,000 years came in the form of a piece of highly advanced technology, a computer that looked and felt like a blank piece of paper. He pulled it out and looked at it again. In reality, it looked like the type of paper he'd expect to see in a scroll, which would be useful if he happened to be caught reading the screen. He checked it and found nothing useful. In fact, the original letter he'd read when he found the time machine gone had vanished. He remembered reading that his wife was now about 16 years old, and that she'd soon lose her mother, if she hadn't already. His fist clenched. Elizabeth had been used by her own father. He remembered that. So it was his job to take care of her. She lived in the earliest group of the Aliamenti, and that meant he'd need to join up. He had no idea how to accomplish such a feat, though. If they'd developed modest energy levels, he could pretend to be quite intuitive in the energy's usage and help advance their skills. He suspected, however, that a group that would cause harm to a young girl wouldn't be trustworthy. Therefore, he'd show nothing of his energy skills until he needed to do so, until he was sure he could trust them. He stopped walking. He wasn't a compulsive student of history, but he did know that people had grown taller on average over time. At 6 feet tall, Will would likely be by far the tallest man around in this era, tall enough to cause fear and unnecessary curiosity. He also remembered that one of the hunters mentioned that he was taller than they remembered. Both of those bits of information meant that Will needed to shrink before he met up with any of the Aliamenti. Modern medicine might be able to use surgical procedures to reduce the size of his bones. Will had no access to modern hospitals. If he still had the time machine, he could go back to the future and undergo the surgery, after first berating his children and their friend, Adam. That wasn't an option, and he had to work with the skills and technology he had. That meant his energy and nanos, the microscopic intelligent machines that could combine to form nearly any shape or perform any task he could imagine, had to be the answer. Will suspected that if he was about 3 inches shorter, he'd still be relatively tall, but not dramatically so. With nothing to base it on, he pushed his energy around so that it surrounded his body and infused every cell, and pictured himself shrinking until the top of his head was about the previous level of his eyes. Much to his surprise, he could feel the effects of shrinking begin only a few moments later, a sensation that his body was being compacted. His muscles became larger and more defined. He realized that he was losing height without losing mass. When he felt the shrinking effect stop, he He glanced at one of the trees nearby. It was difficult to be certain, but the lowest branches of the closest tree did seem to be farther from the top of his head than they'd been just moments earlier. Satisfied that he'd succeeded in his height-altering goal, Will began moving again. After walking deeper into the forest, Will spotted a high fence, more like the walls circling a town ahead of him. It was a strange sight. He'd never considered that someone might build walls or a fence inside a forest, but conceded that it might be wise. In fact, for a group like the First Adiamenti, it was likely a necessity, for if they were found, they could legally be required to resume their roles as serfs. It was unlikely they'd go quietly, however, and the walls suggested that they intended to fight anyone seeking to return them to their beginnings. As he searched for an opening in the fence, he reviewed the backstory he'd invented for himself. Thankfully, it mirrored his actual story. Thieves, incorrectly believing that he'd stolen from them, set upon his wife and son and killed them, burning the family home down in the process. Left with no family, no home, and no possessions save for his money pouch and the clothes he wore, he left his town, walking aimlessly, and electing to do so until he saw a new town. He'd move into that community, if possible, and begin his life in new surroundings. He chose a random direction, started walking, and found himself here. He'd been a merchant and had enjoyed modest financial success, so he did have some money to pay for food and lodging. Will wasn't able to find a gap in the walls, and the only entry into the community, a gate, was locked. Since he'd neither seen nor heard any sign of inhabitants of the village, he climbed the wall and jumped down inside. Once inside, he walked around, observing the layout and looking for someone from whom he might request lodging. He suspected that this was where his future wife lived, for the obvious efforts at secrecy and defense fit with the few clues he had about her past and with the earliest days of the Adiamenti. The buildings were constructed of rough, hand-hewn beams and featured thatched roofs that sloped down in one direction. The bulk of the buildings on the perimeter were small, as evidenced by the closely spaced doors and tiny windows. Will was reminded of the college dorm rooms in his day. These small rooms shared common walls. A second double of rooms was built at the far end of the village, creating a small street within the village. Small wooden signs were fastened to each room's door with a single name scrawled using what looked like paint. The center of the village was dominated by a series of shops that looked to provide the tools needed to create a wide variety of crafts. He saw large stone hearths, which he suspected could be used for baking, or even smelting metal for shaping into weapons or tools. On the opposite side of the center section were buildings that looked like they were used to store finished products. Two of the buildings looked like grain silos. Nearest to the gate was what amounted to a courtyard, an open area save for a large stone well with a winch used for fetching water. There were several paddocks he walked by to his left as he looked back at the gate, where he saw pigs, cows, goats, and chickens. A large stable occupied one corner nearest the gate, and Will suspected he'd find horses inside the structure. Will turned to his right, where he spotted the two largest buildings inside the fortress. One was of similar construction to the other small buildings that Will had speculated were single-person dwellings, but was over twice the size of the others. Written on the nameplate were the words, "Arthur Lowell and Family." Will frowned, realizing that none of the other nameplates mentioned families or provided family names. The other structure was the largest building he had seen, and he inspected it more closely as he completed his circuit through the community. It was unique in that it had no person's name scratched on the identifying plate, but rather a phrase, "Alio incrementum scola. He choked back a startled gasp as he...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?